It's Friday, February 21st, 2003, 9:06 a.m. on this fine morning in Santa Cruz and the Monterey Bay. It's time for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. We'll be talking about processors with Harry Goldstein of IEEE magazine Spectrum. During the second half of the show, I will welcome your calls to join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll be giving out those numbers again when I invite you to participate in about a half hour. This program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. In the air room with me, John Tracy and Miles Elam. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thanks, Lyle.
Hey, Lyle.
So Apple announced yesterday, I think, OS 10.2.4, that's what it's called. It's a free update. If you're running OS 10, get it. You just do that by doing software update under System Preferences. Quark finally released OS 10 version, right, John? You want to fill us a little bit more into that, or is that pretty much all there is to say?
It's pretty much all there is to say.
They've been lagging behind for a long time, and now they're actually making the move. So
they said they weren't ever since OS 10 was coming out, and they finally did.
And I would say that this is going to increase the level of people going to OS 10 as native, because Quark is a kind of a standard application. It's a layout program used by magazines and other print firms.
Competitor to PageMaker.
Western Digital releases enterprise ATA drives for fast as SCSI, but 30% less expensive. Can you cover that a little bit more detail?
Sure. Western Digital's ATA drives, like a 36 gigabyte drive will cost you around $160, as opposed to a SCSI equivalent, which would be around $200. So it's about 30% less. The reason SCSI drives are so much more expensive is the way they're tested. They're tested individually. Each drive is tested. So if you have a server and you need a really reliable drive, you'd want to get a SCSI drive because it has been individually tested. As opposed to ATA drives, which are tested in batches.
All right. And in the Microsoft area, Microsoft lost a appeal. Miles, you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, Washington Court of Appeals. Microsoft has lost a suit with a former partner, or a current partner, actually, Timeline, about DataMart technology with SQL Server 7. It's important because it may turn out that customers of SQL Server 7 that have added on extra code for functionality may have to pay licensing fees to Timeline. In many cases, it may be into the millions of dollars. If you're just using SQL Server 7 without having written any code inside the database server itself, you're not held by this at all.
Only if you start using their GUI tools to create code inside?
Basically, yeah.
Okay.
I wonder why Microsoft isn't picking up the bill for this.
Well, I guess maybe that's what the case is about, in some regard.
Well, the license agreement that Timeline and Microsoft had was that Microsoft was allowed to use their technology for bundling with it, but the customers would be responsible for the licensing.
So the suit alleges.
Yeah. However, many customers are angry because Microsoft had told them that they wouldn't have to. Of course, the other side being that Microsoft wasn't actually giving legal advice, so there's a whole back and forth there. But there are some folks talking about suing Microsoft for the money to pay for these licenses.
So, Miles, your room was finally discovered. The coldest spot in the universe was discovered last week. and I guess it's not your room, but it's 1 degree Kelvin above absolute zero. Is that what it's
called?
Yes.
That's cold.
Yeah, the Centaurus constellation. It's 5,000 light years from Earth. It's a nebula, a gas cloud from a dying star. And has a temperature of -272 degrees Fahrenheit.
That is cold. Colder than your room, I think.
Just a little bit.
Project Steve. What's Project Steve?
Project Steve is a response from the National Center for Science Education with regard to creationist commentary that there are a large number of scientists that believe that evolution is complete bunk. What they were doing is compiling a group of scientists together saying that no, and the majority of scientists do believe that evolution is sound. But they were doing it in a parody way, and that's what Project Steve was about, was they collected a bunch of scientists named Steve. They were actually aiming for 100. They're at about 220 scientists now, almost all of them having PhDs, saying that, yes, I assert that. You know, and they go for the biological sciences and the geological sciences.
So in general, it's a scientific consensus that, yes, evolution is actually the way life is.
Yeah, that
in this
we all generally agree that this happened.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the news, gentlemen.
You're welcome.
Welcome.
For more than 20 years, chip manufacturers have been improving processes at an amazing rate, doubling performance every year, or to 18 months. But difficulties loom on the horizon. Today, the state-of-the-art chips have transistors roughly a micrometer in overall length. Dozens of them could perch on the top of a human red blood cell. That's how small they are. The smaller the transistors get, and the more they're stuffed into the chip, do the small wire interconnections capacitance variance increase as the size decreases, having an overall negative effect on the performance of the chip? So that's the general baseline of what we're talking about today.
Explain for folks who aren't good.
Yeah, what's that mean in English?
Yeah, what capacitance is.
Capacitance is the... Well, you know what? Let's go with Harry for getting the details of that. But in general, capacitance is the restrictance to current change. So as current is going along a wire, if there's two wires next to it, well, in general, it's the storage of electricity. So if you're storing electricity on something that you want to be passing electricity through, your capacitance value is higher than you really want it to be. Every wire has capacitance value, and they also have inductance value. It's kind of the opposite of capacitance. It means that once you want to stop flow of electricity, it keeps going. If you have
and it really affects two wires in parallel.
Right. So when you're talking about a very, very small chip, and the wires are really close together, you want to try to find some kind of insulator that stops the capacitance problems between the two wires, or you can't increase its speed. That's what we're going to be covering with Harry Goldstein, Senior Associate Editor at IEEE Spectrum Magazine. Now, IEEE is a nonprofit organization set up to define standards. We're very common with a lot of the standards. 1394 is an IEEE standard. There's a lot of standards that you hear. Now, the Spectrum Magazine is basically a magazine for IEEE and its issues. And Harry Goldstein, a senior associate editor, now joins us via phone. Welcome, Harry, to GeekSpeak.
Hey, Lyle.
Thank you very much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
So, how does a microprocessor work? Let's get the basics down.
That's a good question. How does a microprocessor work?
Well, let's talk. I talked about a chip. You heard me just a second ago when I mentioned that
right. They
have small transistors on them. But basically, transistors are a whole bunch of switches. And the more
right.
you get on there, the more processing or switching power you have.
Exactly. And you're sending, you know, exactly.
That's basically it.
And on and you were also talking about capacitance.
Yeah, you want to help define capacitance?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, look at today's Pentium 4 chip has about 4.8 kilometers of wires per
wow.
square centimeter.
Wow.
And that's in both wires next to each other and wires above and below. Because today's chips are roughly 6 to 8 layers of insulation and wires, and on the very bottom of the chip you have which is called the substrate. That's where the actual transistors are built. So to send signals around in useful circuits in a useful manner to conduct logical functions or to call things in and out of memory, you route these wires locally and on the top layers of the chip. That's something called global wiring. And basically
these layers act as the wires? Is that what you're saying?
Well, basically the wires are embedded in the layers.
Okay.
Right? So, and what you have now is that, you know, basically from wire to wire, you hear people talking about 130 nanometers, 90 nanometers, and basically what they're talking about is what the smallest feature size is on a chip, and this is becoming more and more important. Right now, from the center of one wire to the center of its neighboring wire, the smallest dimension is 130 nanometers. And that's where you get the 4.8 kilometers of wire on the Pentium 4.
Okay. Can you put into realm what that size really means?
A micron is 130 nanometers or 0.13 micron. A micron is about 100 times smaller than the width of a human hair.
So we're talking about 1,000 times smaller than the width.
Exactly.
Of a human
hair. Okay. So you're talking microscopic dimensions.
Okay. And that's the space between the wires. The wires are actually thinner than that.
Exactly.
Oh, that's the space between the centers of the wires, actually.
The centers of the wires from one wire to the next. And to give you an idea, I mean, that from going from 130 nanometers to 90 nanometers, that's 4.8 kilometers of wires per square centimeter to about 6.9 kilometers of wire per square centimeter.
Half again as much.
Exactly. So you're getting, basically the idea is that, since the wires are also getting thinner, the signals are passing down the wires at a slower rate.
Why are they getting passed down the wires at a slower rate
just,
as the wires
just,
get thinner?
Just because there's less wire to, there's basically less room for an electrical pulse or less capacity. The wire has less capacity to pass a signal or an electrical pulse.
You can suck more water through a hose than through a straw.
Exactly.
More electrons can flow through a larger space.
Exactly. And so the idea that,
Are you saying that resistance increases with these wires as they decrease in size?
Yes. And that actually has been a problem that people have solved in the late 90s by using a different material.
So they were
instead
using
of
like
aluminum wires, they've moved to copper wires.
And the copper, of course, has a better flow of electricity or less resistance than
exactly.
the aluminum.
Exactly.
And copper is pretty high up on the conductivity chart, right below like silver, right below gold and then silver, which is one of the betters of common materials. Is there any thought to go to like silver, or is the heat problem just too much?
Well, there's also the expense problem too, right?
Right.
I mean, silver is just a more expensive metal. There's probably some heat issues, but they've got the chip industry has many, many other problems to
right.
deal with before the materials of the wire.
A few years ago, the resistance was the issue. You couldn't really get small enough wires without increasing the resistance so much. So they switched to copper, and now they get the smaller wires, and so the other problems resolved. And
right. And
most of what we're talking about is this capacitance problem between these 130 nanometer apart wires.
Exactly.
Okay.
And the problem sort of arises from two things. First, how close the wires are packed together, and also the dielectric constant, or K value.
What? I'm sorry, the what? What does that mean?
The dielectric constant is measures the extent to which material concentrates an electric field. So the idea is that you want an insulation between your wires that doesn't suck the electricity off the wire to create a capacitor.
Okay, but what we're talking about with the dielectric constant was we're talking about the resistance to flow of electricity or the insulation around the wire.
Right.
So just like at home, your lamp doesn't have bare wires going to the wall. It has plastic or rubber insulation around it.
Exactly.
These wires need insulation or they'll interact with each other.
Exactly, and you get what's called crosstalk, which means you get signals basically crossing each other on these wires. And so
without this insulation, there's even spacing. There's not going to be like a short, but there will be a situation where the flow on one wire affects the other wire. And
exactly.
That's what crosstalk is, correct?
Right. You're right.
Okay.
So the basic thing to know here is that as the K value of an insulator between two wires decreases, so does the capacitance. So the problem now is that the wires are getting closer together, the capacitance is building, and even as the transistor speeds are speeding up. So today's insulator du jour is silicon dioxide, or oxide as it's known in the industry, and it has a K value of 4.2, and that just won't do the job in the next generation of chips, where the feature sizes are down to 90 nanometers, as we've been discussing. And those feature sizes are supposed to come online this year. So this is really a make-or-break year for the chip-making industry.
What is the best or the sought-after, the perfect K-value or insulator?
The perfect K-value and perfect insulator is air, which has a K-value approaching 1. And so the new low-K materials that are coming out on the market now have values between 2.9 and 2.6, and that's compared to today's 4.2. So they've managed with these this new generation of low-K materials to drastically reduce the K-value of the insulators.
Okay, I'm going to try to sum this up in a less technical way.
Sure, sure.
So basically, the insulator that's being used right now, or the shielding basically on the wires inside the chip right mm-hmm. now, is silicon dioxide, or oxide as it's called in the industry.
Right.
And basic silicon dioxide, I'm assuming, what can you give us an example of what silicon dioxide is in a human level scale?
What it is in a human, it's basically silicon, which is the building block of
sand
and oxygen.
Okay. So, and is it, you know, silicon to oxide? Or
yeah.
Silicon, okay. So it's kind of like as H2O is, this is a compound that's very similar to, or has.
Exactly.
Two,
and it's been extremely effective for a number of years.
Okay. And so now that rating is at 4.2. We'd really like to see a rating of 1. And the new stuff that's coming out has like a 2.9 to 2.6. So it's getting twice, almost twice as good at its purpose of insulating.
Right.
Okay. All right. So what are these new insulators called?
They're basically called low-K materials, but there are actually two different approaches, and this is where it becomes a little bit of a dicey proposition for the chip-making industry, because Intel and Motorola and TSMC, which is the world's largest chip foundry located in Taiwan, they all have to make decisions about which of these two different kinds of materials that are out on the market, which to choose. And the first one is offered by Dow Chemical, and it is a polymer. The idea is that you drip the polymer onto a spinning wafer. It's called spin-on deposition. And this polymer has air, pores, sort of built into it. And it's much like if you went to carnivals or fairs and you would spill the paint on the spinning disc and make a pattern. I mean, that's essentially what it is, except it's a very uniform deposition technique. The other technique, which is offered by companies like Applied Materials and Novellus, is it's called chemical vapor deposition. And basically what that means is that you are precipitating particles onto a wafer in a heated chamber.
Oh, gosh, it's so geeky. I love it. Okay,
yeah,
I'm still following you, but I don't think anybody else is.
Oh,
so,
God,
so
I know.
Let's back up to Dow Chemical, and this is the 2.9K, or not as good as the Applied Materials or Novell's solution, but
it's currently at about 2.6 to 2.7.
Dow Chemicals.
It's the chemical vapor deposition or Applied Materials and Novellus approach, which has a higher K value, less desired.
Okay, you explained really well how the polymer is put onto the chip, and that is by spinning it on.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, spin the chip really fast, and you drop it on, and it spreads out evenly because of the consistency of the material.
Right.
And that's called spin-on deposition. I'm assuming deposition in basic means applying.
Depositing.
Okay. So
depositing
that, and Dow's solution actually has the best value, but it's very different than how chips are made right now, because chips in general right now are etched.
Yes.
The material, the different layers are etched. So what you do is you do chemical deposition. You basically heat up a whole bunch of chemicals. You put it in a room with this chip. The chip is cooler, and the chemicals deposit onto the chip, just like a glass of water that's cold that has ice in it sits in a room. All of a sudden, has water on the outside. The water is not actually leaving the cup and going onto the outside. It's actually being collected by the atmosphere. And
mm-hmm.
and that's what you condensation. So basically,
exactly.
When you're talking about Applied Materials solution or Novella solution, the chemical deposition, that's basically like precipitation in our environment.
Exactly.
Okay.
It is in fact exactly like that.
And from what I understand, chips are made by, you take the base substrate, which is a really clean material, silicate, and then you start
and then you start
applying different layers by mostly by doing this. You heat up the material. Let's say you want to put copper on there. You heat up the material into the room, into the environment, and then you let it set, crystallize on top of the substrate. That's in general how they're made, right? So
in
the
chip
manufacturing companies are relatively used to chemical deposition.
Right. Well, and they're also used to spin on deposition as well.
Okay.
Basically, the chip making process is incredibly, incredibly complex. There are many, many steps, and one of the most important steps is the pattern that you put onto the chip. Okay, and that is done by spinning on basically film, like film from a camera, except in this instance, it is a chemical material that's spun on, just as the Dow chemical thing is.
Okay.
And then that film is exposed to light coming through a mask which contains the circuit pattern.
So people are familiar.
So that's how you get the circuits imprinted onto the chip.
So how people are familiar with silk screening, you basically, the process is similar. When you make your silk screen, you take a chemical that can be washed off, and you apply light to the chemical in a certain pattern, and the chemical then adheres at that pattern of light, and then when you wash it, the stuff that didn't get hit by light gets washed away.
Exactly.
So generally, that's how chips are made. You make this very complicated structure of the chip on some, I'm assuming, some kind of material that's printed, and then you pass light through it onto the chip substrate, which has the photoemulsion stuff on it, and then you acid wash it, and the only thing that's left is your pattern. And basically, by doing multiple layers of these on top of each other, you actually build the chip.
Exactly.
So these are the wires. When you're talking about there's so many miles of wires, these are the wires you're laying down through this process?
Exactly. I mean, that's that you're laying down the patterns for the wires to be filled in with metal.
Right.
And that's done through a precipitation?
No. It's actually the photoresist, the material that you're creating the patterns on, is done with a spin-on process like Dow's.
Okay. Right.
So that's where that's where these two camps sort of start sparring with each other, right? They say, you know, Applied Materials will say you have to go, you know, with spin-on deposition, you have to go to an entirely new process, which will cost you millions of dollars to implement. With our process, you just use the chemical vapor deposition chambers, the ovens where these chips are made, and this precipitation of the materials happens. You just use the ones you already have, and so it's a hard decision for these companies to make, because these fabs, these chip fabs, are $2 billion a pop, right? There's a lot of money at stake, and the bottom line is that you have to have these materials one way or the other, and both of these materials have a lot of problems associated with them. We were talking about the very clean surface that you need for the chip. Another very important process is that as each layer is made, the layer is polished with a slurry of abrasives and a spinning head. And what happens on both of these different materials, both of these low-k materials, is that the spinning head rips up the wires and destroys the chip in many instances. There are a number of reasons for this, but that the bottom line is that you lose a lot of chips.
And that's with both of the different solutions.
That's with both of the different solutions.
And that's the rub.
And that's the rub.
Okay.
I mean, they both have their advantages, but they both have their problems. I mean, the problems have been worked out to a certain extent, but it's this year when you really need to have these low-k materials to make these smaller dimensions on the chip that we're going to find out whether or not, you know, these problems have been solved.
Right.
So there's this blind faith in Moore's law just sort of trips along, la-di-da, you know, doubling performance, halving cost, and every 18 months or whatever.
And unless these problems are solved, that won't continue.
Exactly. And, and let me emphasize that this is just one problem that faces the chip industry.
And we might get into more in just a minute.
Sure.
You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks John Tracy and Miles Elam. We've been speaking with Harry Goldstein, Senior Associate Editor at IEEE's magazine Spectrum. If you would like to join the discussion, you may call 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. This is Central Coast Public Radio. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services including DSL and spam filters for home and office throughout Santa Cruz County. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. If you have experience with chips, if you want to know more about chips, or if you want to ask more questions pertaining to other subjects, please call in. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877.
This is John Tracy bringing you today's Geek Bit. Computer memory. What exactly is computer memory? Well, there are two kinds: RAM, where things happen, and storage, fixed media such as a hard drive, a CD-ROM, or floppy disk, where things are kept in a more permanent fashion. RAM is where things happen because it's fast. When you double-click an icon, like an application, your computer loads the program from the hard drive into RAM. Once it's there, the computer can access the data much faster. However, RAM needs a constant supply of electricity to keep the information stored there. As soon as you turn off the machine, the information in RAM, it's lost. That's where fixed media, like a hard drive, comes in. It's much slower than RAM. For example, if it took 3 minutes to retrieve a piece of data from the hard drive, it would take only 2 seconds to retrieve it from RAM. However, it writes the information using a more permanent method. When the electricity is turned off, the information is still there. So what about virtual memory? Virtual memory is a portion of the hard drive pretending it's RAM. The computer loads part of the application onto a specific place on the hard drive where it can retrieve instructions from it as though it were RAM. It takes much longer, of course, but it allows a program to run that would not normally have been able to. It's a holdover from the days when RAM was very expensive and not as available as it is now. Today, all modern operating systems have some form of virtual memory so the computer can free up space and RAM as it's needed. So, when a program, or your child, asks you for more memory, they usually mean RAM. When you run out of space to store stuff, you need a larger storage device, like a hard drive. This has been John Tracy with your Geek Bit. Join us for Geek Speak, Fridays, 9 to 10 a.m. here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
And you are listening to KUSP. We're talking about processor technology with Harry Goldstein, Senior Associate Editor at IEEE Spectrum Magazine. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks in the air room are John Tracy and Miles Elam. Please join our discussion by calling 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You're welcome to ask questions not pertaining to chip manufacturing. Again, the phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Harry, how big are these chips that we're talking about that have kilometers of wire in them?
Well, you can crack open your desktop PC and take a look. I mean,
centimeter?
Well, no, they're more than that, I would think. They're, you know, whatever, sort of the length of your, about half of your finger on each side, maybe.
Okay.
So I was always curious because if you look inside a case that has a Pentium processor, there's mm-hmm. a huge black slab in there with heat sinks all over it. And it's,
right.
I've always been curious, well, how big is the actual chip inside there?
Yeah, well, it's much smaller than that. The packaging around it is, you have to attach all kinds of wires to it to get the signals out and to different parts of the circuit board and all of that. So it's quite a bit smaller.
Now, you said that in these new technologies, what they're having right now is that wires get ripped up in the polishing phase of that layer.
Something I was wondering about, I'd read about, was that yields affect the final market price. For example,
right.
when you just start off with a chip, you have your large wafer that you're or large die, and you have all of your prospective CPUs on there, and there's a high failure rate to begin with.
Right. The failure rates, I mean, depending on the processor, anywhere from 10 to 50%. Depending on how small you're trying to go, and especially when you're starting out with a new size or a new a new technology node, there are a lot more failures as you get the process right. So that's why initially a lot of times you'll see processors expensive, and then they wind up dropping in price later on as the yields rise. But that's definitely a problem.
They were refining the process and making sure that more chips per die end up...
Exactly. Yep.
How large are these dies?
The dies themselves, it's hard to say. I mean, they vary from process to process. I mean, the wafers that the dies are cut from are today, state-of-the-art is 300 millimeters in diameter. But most chips are still made on wafers that are about 200 millimeters in diameter.
And that's 300 millimeters is about a third of a meter, or
about
a
foot.
About a foot.
About a foot wide.
Not that we like to use that horrible system on GeekSpeak, but everyone listening understands that.
Yeah, you get hundreds or thousands of chips depending on how big the chip is.
And that's a fascinating process all by itself, how those wafers are made and such. But we do have a phone call, and we're going to take that right now. Doug from Santa Cruz, question about OS 10?
Hi,
yeah. Doug.
I downloaded OS 10.2.4 about 2 days ago, and I've been having significant clock problems since then. There are two forums, one forum on Apple's website and another on Mac World that have been discussing this for a couple of days. There appears to be a real problem when the Mac is shut down and the clock resets to 1/1/1970.
Are you using a network time server?
Well, I've switched to using a network time server in order to correct that, but if you're trying to work with your own with the internal clock, then the clock resets itself.
Yeah, I've been reading about this. This is a lot of people have brought in their Macs to shops, complaining that they thought their battery was dead.
That's correct.
But in fact, it's a software glitch.
So I believe
I'm really
glad
to call for it, though.
Yeah, I would recommend. My personal feeling is that folks ought to wait a week or so before they download 10.2.4.
And we can apprise people of that next week when we do the show again. We'll tell you the status. Well, Doug, thank you. John and I are both looking at you aghast because we both have titaniums, and I don't shut mine down. I put it to sleep. John, you the same way?
Same here.
So we haven't seen it. So I'm glad that you called in to let us know that it happened. And, of course, Miles, the non-Mac guy, knows all about it, which is great.
Well, I read about it. I didn't think about it off the top of my head. It was he said that. I'm glad you reminded me. I totally forgot about that.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Let people know that be forewarned.
So don't order your 10.2.4 update CD yet, because there's probably a 10.2.5 coming out right behind it.
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
So we were talking about processors. Harry, you still there?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good. So, yeah, the whole process of actually growing the substrate or the material that the chip's actually made on, that very base level,
is
pretty complex, right?
Yeah, it's called epitaxy. And basically, it's exactly what you said. It's you grow these, you use a seed of silicon, and you grow them in a vacuum chamber, and they're sort of like magic rocks, if you can remember back to the 70s, like I can, and except they're pure crystal, and that's the key. For many years, it was very difficult to grow these things, and now they've come up with all kinds of ways to dope or put different kinds of atoms and molecules inside of the crystal for different kinds of properties.
So it's almost a silicon alloy.
Uh-huh. It is.
That's great. This sounds like it would be a great space-based production.
One would think. And in fact, that was that's always been touted as that, and pharmaceuticals have always been touted as a good use for the International Space Station. But it's just way too expensive and impractical.
We need a space elevator.
So we're talking about the chip processes and how difficult it is after you get the substrate and start laying all these things on. There's polishing levels and they're ripping things up. What other obstacles do companies have in going to this better insulator type?
What other obstacles do they have in going to the better insulator? It actually begins well before the insulator. Like I said, I mean, this is really just the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole process that goes on in software, the design of these chips, before they even make it to the fab, that, I mean, the software basically hasn't kept pace with the hardware and physical process improvements. And so, basically, you have the ability to put, whatever, 100, 200 million transistors on a chip, but it's becoming increasingly difficult to effectively design circuits that can take advantage of all of these different transistors. So that's another roadblock that people are butting up against.
Now, of course, this whole process is a pretty chemical-rich process. There's a lot of chemicals involved here.
Yes.
And we got a call from Mandy of Carmel, and she wanted to know what the environmental impact of microprocessor manufacturing is.
Well, there are probably more Superfund sites in Silicon Valley than the rest of the United States. I mean, that's sort of where most of the Superfund sites are. It's
Superfund site being a place where you would never want to let your kids play.
Pretty much. Although,
highly toxic.
I mean, yeah, basically, they're very caustic chemicals. I mean, we were talking about chemical vapor deposition. Well, one of the vapors you put in there is argon, which is an inert gas. But a lot of what happens is that you get these waste streams of different chemicals that, while might have been pure and not so caustic to begin with, end up being that way. You get a lot of hydrochloric acid. You get a lot of other much nastier chemicals. And I mean, just the etching process. You know, we were talking about stripping away the exposed or the non-exposed parts of the film that go on to make the circuit. All of that. I mean, that's acid etching, and that acid has to go somewhere. Now, there are a number of, you know, Applied Materials and other equipment manufacturers for the semiconductor industry have started working on cleaner processing techniques, but they're more expensive and they haven't gotten they're really just at the beginning stages, and so environmental impact is definitely, the Silicon Valley Toxic Coalition, something along those lines. I mean, there are a number of advocacy groups in Silicon Valley that are trying to get the word out about this stuff. I mean, there's a pending case against a large chip manufacturer, and I hesitate to name them because I'm not sure if it's actually them, but in Silicon Valley, where people have a very high rate of breast cancer. Workers have a high rate of breast cancer. So there's a class action suit going on there.
And
that's just, once again, that could well be just the tip of the iceberg.
So it's another reason to keep your machine around as long as possible. Don't upgrade just because you can afford it necessarily. Maybe keep the machine around and because you have to respect that it takes a lot to produce these things.
And on the other end, don't throw your computer away to the dump.
Because,
ever.
Again, that's bad.
Right. Right. Well, and actually, in Europe, we had a feature story a few months ago about, where do these computers go? And a lot of them get sent to dumping grounds in Asia, as you wouldn't want to have someone dumping nuclear waste in your backyard. You know, these poorer countries are importing you know, are garbage.
And when you said you did an article, you're talking about
IEEE Spectrum did an article, Tekla Perry.
And the magazine, the article, the magazine and the article can be learned. You can learn more about the magazine at www.spectrum.iee.org. And we have Dave from Santa Cruz. Hello, Dave. Thank you for calling in with more information on OS 10.
Oh, yeah, I have a new iMac. I got it last December, and I downloaded 10.2.4 about a week ago, and I haven't had any clock problems because I shut down fairly regularly at night, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Fidelity is, it doesn't matter if you just keep it on sleep all the time. You're not using it?
No, you can keep it on sleep. It's pretty low impact. You can tell how much your machine is being, how much wasted energy it's using, because that will turn that into heat. So if you just, when you close your notebook, if you feel that it gets cool, in the middle of the night it's cold, then you basically aren't using that much. You're using trickle amount of current.
Okay.
But yeah, this effect, this clock effect, is not going to affect everybody. I'm assuming it's going to be only some
maybe
patterns
certain,
of hardware.
Certain older machines, maybe.
Possibly. Makes sense.
Yeah. And a question on streaming audio, like the
yeah, go ahead and ask.
Pardon?
Go ahead.
This iMac I've got has a certain selection of radio stations you can stream,
mm-hmm.
and not including KUSB, say.
Yeah.
Because KUSB has a different format, I guess, they operate through.
That's right.
And I was told by Apple there's about five different ones around around the world. And are they going to get together and come down with a standard or something on this?
Oh, that'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Well, I can tell you that this coming week I'll be sitting down with some people from Cruise.io, who helps KUSB out with their ISP, and KUSB's webmaster, and we're going to be looking into better streaming solutions. We might want to look at the iTunes possibility of supporting Macs a little more friendly.
Yeah, that's what I got here.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Dave, for your call.
All right.
Yeah, definitely. Streaming, different streaming technologies, it'd be nice if there's one standard, but there's not. There's many. And right now, KUSB is using real audio. Actually, right now, it's not functioning, which is one of the reasons why we want to get onto a better, more open, stable environment like some other source. And maybe we'll have Real Audio to talk about their technology at some point. I don't want to demean them in that way. We are talking with Harry Goldstein, Senior Associate Editor at IEEE Spectrum Magazine, and we're talking about processors. But please, if you'd like to call in with questions, comments, the phone numbers are 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Harry,
mm-hmm.
you talked a little bit about the difficulties in the chip manufacturing process and such, but from your perspective of being in this arena and knowing it pretty well, what do you think the leaders are going to go into? What type will be used?
Which will be the winner? That's a good question. I mean, certainly Motorola has gone ahead and chosen Applied Materials' Black Diamond process for their next generation of chips. But the problem is that the chemical vapor deposition technique that Applied Materials uses is only going to give you the performance you need for, say, the next 2 or 3 years, down to about, we're at 130 nanometers now. This year we go to 90 nanometers, and down around 45 nanometers, which is two generations, they can't provide the low enough K, low enough dielectric constant in the insulator to make it down to those levels, and apparently, according to Dow and other companies that use a similar polymer spin-on process, or who are developing it, they can get down, you know, maybe to the generations, a couple of generations beyond that. I mean, ultimately, you're looking at The idea that we can just keep going on making things smaller and smaller might not even be the point in a couple of generations.
Because it will just become physically impossible to do so.
Well, not only physically impossible, but not necessarily even desirable. Because we're going to have, the idea that, the desktop is no longer going to be the center of the universe 5 years from now, and it's increasingly less so in other parts of the world. It's the idea of these, of distributed computing platforms on your PDAs, handheld devices, on your cell phones when 3G actually comes to fruition, maybe in a year or so,
or more.
That what becomes important at that point is low power. Right, because you want longer battery life, and that's sort of where the industry, the companies that can't keep pumping money into new semiconductor fabs are going to be looking to leverage the investments they've already made in their current technology and see how they what kinds of chips they can make that meet a different set of needs rather than just raw processing power.
Something I'm wondering is there a feeling in the industry that they're kind of saying, well, we've gotten chips pretty much the speed we want now, and we're going for other things, like you said, using less power, less heat?
I think increasingly that's where we're going, because as I said, increasingly you're going to battery-powered, untethered.
And not only that, but the cost to keep at the top of the curve is more expensive than going for a few generations back. Google made an announcement not that long ago that they weren't going to be buying the top-of-the-line machines to power their systems, but that they're going to use a few generations back because they're a lot cheaper and they do what they need. They have
right, and the collective gas coming from Intel was, you could probably hear all over your area of the country. Even on your computer right now, if you play a lot of computer games, as one of my colleagues here at Spectrum does, he was saying, well, all I really need, I'm okay with my 1 gigahertz processor. What if I want to upgrade, I'm going to get a better video card, right? So the emphasis is going in different directions. And in fact, the microprocessor, as we know it, is becoming... It's changing. It's becoming not necessarily the central part of what is the big trend that's happening right now, and which is driving a lot of this need to go to smaller dimensions. It's called system on a chip, where your microprocessor is actually embedded as part of a chip that has many other kinds of functionality on it, like a digital signal processor, an analog to digital converter, radio, like Bluetooth capabilities, or IEEE 802.11 capabilities.
All inside the chip?
All on one single chip. And what's happening is that companies like ARM, ARM, and MIPS, which you may have heard of, they're doing incredibly well right now, because another big trend in the semiconductor industry is that a lot of companies, because they can't afford fabs, just design different parts of these systems on a chip, and people, different vendors, like say Nokia, uses a particular set of these different components and puts it together in their own recipe.
So that's where
a lot of attention is being focused.
So the behemoth processor is focusing on speed, which we've been seeing since the growth of the PC.
Mm-hmm.
So the PC, that immense competition to get the highest speed. We, at this point, we're kind of seeing a dwindling of that focus on speed, and that multiple little companies like ARM and MIPS are starting to design parts, or different companies are starting to design little parts that will go into complex chips that
yes.
we might be seeing more and more of in the future.
Yes, absolutely, especially if you want smaller portable devices.
So the future is smaller, cheaper, but not necessarily faster then?
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, faster will come. People are still going to continue down this technology path, which is actually there's something called a roadmap, which is published by the International Technology Roadmap for Semiconductors Association. It's basically a consortium of university researchers and corporate researchers who decide what the grand challenges are for the semiconductor industry, and that's actually available as a PDF online if you
where?
Care to have your hair raised enough to...
Where is that available, do you know? What's it called again?
It is called the International Technology Roadmap for Semiconductors, and if you give me a second, I might be able to Google it up here.
Well, what we'll do is I'll just put that on the website later today. So
okay.
When this shows up on MP3 format on geekspeak.org, so will the information regarding links and such we talked about today.
Okay. Can I throw in one other thing?
Please
I was
do.
Just at the Intel Developers Forum, and even Intel is looking at smaller portable devices as sort of the future of the company, just as Microsoft has tried to get into the smartphone industry and push its Windows CE and Talisker embedded platforms.
It's so kind of exciting that we'll be seeing a different focus in the tech realm, mm-hmm. rather than just the speed.
Yeah.
Also,
absolutely.
it's it'll be nice in the sense that, well, you know, your 2 gigahertz processor is great, top of the line, and you don't need anything faster for a while. Might be kind of a relief, especially since chip manufacturing is so difficult, expensive, and environmentally unstable or dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to that. Anything else? Well, let me just mention your website again, the IEEE Spectrum magazine, IEEE being a body that regulates standards, www.spectrum.iee.org. And this program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. Harry Goldstein, thank you very much for joining us. Harry Goldstein is a senior associate editor at IEEE Spectrum Magazine, www.spectrum.iee.org. Thank you, Harry.
Thank you. It's enjoyable.
Geeks John Tracy and Miles Elam, thanks.
Always a pleasure.
Yep.
Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Thank you all for your participation in GeekSpeak. To those that called in, thank you for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without your input, it would just be us geeking out, and who wants to listen to that?
I'm Ira Glass. Later today on This American Life, detectives. David Sedaris picks up pointers on how to be a private eye from television.
It seemed that anyone could solve a murder just so long as they had a telephone, a few hours of spare time, and a wet bar.
I go out with a real private eye on a stakeout, on a car chase.
She went straight down the alley, right?
Yeah. Do you think she's trying to lose us?
I don't know.
Later today on This American Life from Public Radio International.
Airing at 7 p.m. here on KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Otter. We're on the web at kusp.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. For all the geeks at GeekSpeak, have a good week. Stay tuned for Fine Print.